prosecutors like to win. I think that motive was the principal operative motive.
The special counsel explains his findings in his report on the Stevens trial. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the rhetoric surrounding controversial Prop 5 in Anchorage heats up.
We can have disagreements, that's understandable, but our disagreements should never veer into the area where we dehumanize.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Association of Alaska School Boards believes that all students should be proficient in reading, writing, and math by the time they finish the third grade. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee today heard from the special counsel who conducted a court-ordered investigation into misconduct in the 2008 trial of former Senator Ted Stevens. Henry Schulke's 500-page report detailing that misconduct was released to the public earlier this month. In it, he describes how federal prosecutors intentionally concealed key information from Stevens' defense team in violation of their Brady disclosure obligation. Schulke told the Judiciary Committee today that those failings were likely motivated by one thing.
I think that motive to win the case was the principal operative motive. I do not believe that any of the prosecutors, including Mr. Botini and Mr. Gakey from Alaska, harbored a personal animus towards Senator Stevens. I don't believe that either of them sought fame and glory, and that's the reason they wanted to win the case. That's just not in their personalities, in my judgment. They did, however, want to win the case.
Schulke says poor supervision of the prosecution team and the compressed schedule leading up to the trial also contributed to unintentional misconduct in the trial. Senator Lisa Murkowski has introduced a bill that would establish a nationwide standard for disclosing important evidence to defendants in federal court. Right now, prosecutors have to turn over evidence they determine is material to the defense. Murkowski's law would compel prosecutors to turn over all evidence. The Justice Department doesn't support the bill, saying it has already made sweeping reforms in the wake of the Stevens trial. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, made the case for the new law.
If we are really serious about avoiding this in the future, don't we have to go further than to trust the instincts of the Department of Justice and prosecutors across America? Don't we have to enshrine in the law some basic protection of the criminal defendant when it comes to this disclosure?
Senator Murkowski submitted written testimony to the Judiciary Committee. She asked the committee to schedule a hearing for her bill and wrote that Schulke's report, quote, chronicles what I believe will be recorded by history among the darkest moments in the Justice Department's 223-year history. Ted Stevens lost his re-election bid 1 week after being convicted of failing to report gifts on Senate disclosure forms. The verdict was thrown out 5 months later when the prosecutor's misconduct surfaced. For decades, the community of King Cove has lobbied for a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge to nearby Cold Bay. Proponents say it's critical for the remote community to have a more reliable way to evacuate medical patients. Conservation groups contend it would devastate critical wildlife habitat. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently issued a draft environmental impact statement for the project, but a final decision about whether it should move forward is still more than a year out. In the meantime, King Cove is already building a road to the edge of the refuge. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports.
In 1998, the Clinton administration shot down the idea of building a road through Eisenbeck on conservation grounds, instead opting to give King Cove a $37 million grant to improve the local clinic and airstrip. The grant also covered the purchase of a $9 million hovercraft to transport medical patients and other passengers to Cold Bay by water for those times when the airport was weathered in. Although the hovercraft was supposed to be a substitute for the road, that plan didn't last long. The Aleutians Eastboro acquired a hovercraft in 2007, but Administrator Sharon Boyette says operating it was too expensive for a borough with fewer than 3,000 residents. So in November 2010, the borough put the hovercraft in storage.
That hovercraft won't run the King Cove Cold Bay route again. I mean, I think a three-year period of time, you know, trying to get the cost down and the revenues up is a significant investment on the borough's behalf.
Boyette says the borough is planning to move the hovercraft down to Accutan for use at the airport that's scheduled to open in that community this summer. Even so, the Department of Transportation is continuing construction on a new road out to a new hovercraft terminal that's being built in King Cove this summer. The borough got $15 million for the road from the Alaska legislature in fiscal year 2011. This year, they're asking for another $4 million, even though the road will end in a hovercraft terminal to nowhere. Boyette says that's because the borough hopes that eventually the road can be extended through the refuge.
What we have said now regarding that road is that our plan A is that the EIS will be successful. You know, the Secretary of Interior will see the benefit, the public benefit, and allow us to build the road all the way through to the airport in Cold Bay.
Boyette says even if the Eisenbeck Road doesn't go through, and even if the hovercraft remains out of service, the road to the terminal won't be a road to nowhere.
Plan B right now is in development, but a vessel that we think has great promise and would use the exact same facilities at the northeast corner and on the Cold Bay side that the hovercraft would use or has used is a landing craft.
In the recently released draft environmental impact statement, the hovercraft is still listed as one of the five options under consideration. Fish and Wildlife spokesperson Bruce Woods couldn't say how the borough's decision to use the hovercraft in Accutan would affect the EIS process.
I haven't heard that there is a lack of a hovercraft yet.
Woods says the final EIS will consider all alternatives. Meanwhile, King Cove Corporation has been enthusiastically pushing for the road, saying it's vital for emergency response. If the Secretary of the Interior approves the project, the corporation has agreed to trade 13,000 acres of their lands, in addition to 43,000 acres of state lands, for the 200 acres of federal refuge lands required to build the road. The idea of expanding the refuge doesn't entice conservation groups, though. Audubon Alaska spokesperson Beth Peluso says it's a question of quality over quantity.
The exchange lands aren't really comparable. You can't just tell those animals, like, hey, by the way, you have to eat over here now.
Peluso says Audubon will continue to advocate for alternatives to the road. She didn't know that King Cove had shelved the hovercraft option because of operational costs. No matter what, it looks like King Cove is building a road to the edge of the refuge and a hovercraft terminal, whether they have something to put in it or not, but they'll still have to wait a while for a decision on the road to Cold Bay. Fish and Wildlife is accepting public comments on the draft environmental impact statement through May 18th and expects a final decision by early next year. In on Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Shell passed another regulatory hurdle today in its quest to drill exploratory wells in the Arctic Ocean this summer. The federal government approved the company's spill response plan for the Beaufort Sea. Shell wants to drill several wells in both the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas beginning in July. They already received approval for their Chukchi spill response plan. Pete Slaby, vice president of Shell Alaska, says it wasn't the final hurdle for the company, but it was a big milestone.
We're excited. This is a potentially pretty big event for Alaska. It will mean jobs, and I think we're looking at the summer, probably over 1,200 jobs.
Slaby says the company is busy getting ready for the summer drilling season. Pending final approval, they will be allowed to transit through the Bering Strait after July 1st. But Slaby says there is more ice than usual in the Arctic Ocean right now, and that could delay the operation.
We're obviously not going to go in if we see a large amount of ice. We'd have to break ice to go in and do this. We want to see ice pretty well clear out of the way before we would start operations. So if we've got information or if we see that it's not clearing, that might indeed impact when we would finally do our sail away.
Environmental groups are criticizing the federal government's decision. They say Shell hasn't proven it has the technology or resources to clean up a potential oil spill in Arctic waters. Chris Krenz is Arctic Project Manager for Oceana. He says the spill response plan that was approved today is inadequate.
These paper plans that get approved don't match reality. In the Deepwater Horizon, they had plans in place that they said would be able to contain and clean up the size of spill that they had, and they didn't come close to doing that.
Krenz says big oil companies have had spills all over the world, and there's no reason to think a spill wouldn't happen in the Arctic. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Unalaska resident discovers internet gold.
It's amazing. Good morning, America. ABC News. Journalist from Australian News wants to do a story.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
The latest reapportionment plan, released yesterday, changes some election district boundaries in interior and western Alaska. But in southeast and many other areas, district lines that were redrawn last year remain. That upsets some community leaders, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Alaska Redistricting Board released the plan, then considered a consultant's report saying it would significantly reduce Alaska Native influence in one House and one Senate district. The plan responds to a recent state Supreme Court ruling saying the board put too much emphasis on protecting Native voting rights. The court said the board should have paid more attention to state constitutional requirements, which call for compact districts made up of similar communities. The new plan changes election district boundaries for part of the Aleutians in the interior, as well as areas around Nome and Bethel. The board's voting rights consultant identified two of the districts redrawn after the court ruling as areas of concern. One is a House district made up of interior villages. The other is a Senate district running from Yakutat to Kodiak and from Lime Village to Dillingham and out the Aleutians. Redistricting Board Executive Director Taylor Bickford says the controversy does not include Panhandle communities.
There was an influence district that was built in southeast, but the board never claimed and the court never found that the board's drawing of an influence district in southeast led to violations of the Alaska Constitution.
Petersburg officials hope for new boundaries closer to its current district, which includes Wrangell and Sitka. Those districts were reworked because of population shifts from southeast to south-central Alaska. The new plan combines Petersburg, downtown Juneau, Douglas Island, and Skagway. That angers Petersburg Mayor Al Dwyer.
We don't think that Juneau is similar in any way to Petersburg or a fishing community. I mean, it has a processor there, but it's not considered a fishing community. It's a tourist community and a government.
I completely understand why people will be unhappy. I think there's a lot of unhappy people across the state.
Juneau Democratic Representative Beth Kurtula serves in the House district slated to include Petersburg.
And all I can say is wherever the district I'm in is, I would be honored to represent it and will work my hardest to do a good job.
Petersburg sued to change last year's reapportionment plan. Mayor Dwyer says the Supreme Court ruling provides another opportunity to challenge the redistricting board.
We kind of knew that they would propose that again, but we're against it and we're going to oppose it.
And what form's that opposition going to be? Are you folks going to go back to court?
Yeah, depending on the cost. We have a limited amount of funds to spend.
The redistricting board is scheduled to meet through Saturday. Executive Director Bickford says it should finish its work by then. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
With less than a week to go until municipal elections, the propaganda war around the Anchorage Equal Rights Initiative is getting nasty. This week, those campaigning for the initiative held a press conference to chastise their opponents and ask that ads they consider offensive be taken off the air. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
An anti-Prop 5 advertisement showing a cartoon of a man dressed in a woman's dress applying for a job at a daycare is causing a stir in Anchorage.
But if Proposition 5 passes, it will be illegal for Carol to refuse a job to a transvestite who wants to work with toddlers. If she hires him, she risks losing customers.
The ad shows a tall man with a stubbly face and hairy legs dressed in a pink mini dress. Those campaigning for the initiative say the imagery perpetuates harmful stereotypes, and they've asked the opposition to pull it. Proposition 5 would change the municipal code to include protections for gay and transgender people. Conservative church leaders say it could infringe upon religious freedoms. Liberal church leaders like Pastor Michael Burke with St. Mary's Episcopal Church say the cartoon ads need to go.
We can have disagreements, that's understandable. But our disagreements should never veer into the area where we dehumanize or make cartoon caricatures that create a real climate of fear of the other that paints them in ways that real people aren't.
Yes on 5, the group promoting the proposition, has fired back with their own commercial, showing a real transgender person, a transgender man who looks typically male, dressed in a gray t-shirt and khaki pants.
My name is Drew. I'm transgender. I was born female, but I've lived fully as a man for many years. It's offensive when people like me are portrayed as a cartoon, or worse yet, someone to be feared.
Jim Minnery is with the anti-Prop 5 group Protect Your Rights that paid for the cartoon ad. He responded to my request for an interview with an email that said, "We stand by the ads, believe they provide a necessary educational moment for our voters, and we have no intention of pulling the ads." The ad controversy comes on the heels of a letter sent by the Catholic Archbishop of Anchorage, Roger Schweitz, to parishioners urging them to oppose Prop 5. Ira Lupu is a professor of law at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. His scholarly specialty is law and religion. He says compared to the rest of the country, the conversation in Anchorage is way behind.
I would say about half the states have laws like this. And even before many of the states did, a number of cities, New York City, Boston, Boulder, Colorado, you know, probably the cities that people would think of as more liberal cities tended to have local citywide ordinances like this. That goes back 20 years or more.
But he says he sees why conservative religious groups are up in arms.
One of the things that really jumps out at me, and I'm sure is part of the cause of the controversy in your Anchorage proposition, is that the only reference I see to freedom of religion is this one paragraph that says it's the intent of this chapter to guarantee legal protections consistent with federal and state constitutions, including freedom of expression, association, and the free exercise of religion. And that's all it says. And the ordinance is very vague.
But Lupu notes there's already an exemption for faith-based hiring in the Anchorage Municipal Code for bona fide religious or denominational organizations. Jeffrey Mittman is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. He says the discourse taking place around the ballot measure is something we should all be paying attention to.
Over our 200-plus years history, we have constantly striven to perfect ourselves as a nation.
It's part of a movement taking place across the country, Mittman says.
America is moving forward just as we battled to win equality for women, just as we fought to ensure that all races are equal. We are now in the midst of a social progress forward to ensure that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are included as American.
Whether Anchorage will join that movement will be determined on voting day, Tuesday, April 3rd. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time home buyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
The State House early this morning approved the next steps necessary that could lead to an in-state gas pipeline from the North Slope to Anchorage and South Central. The bill authorizes $400 million for what is estimated to be a $7 billion project. In a floor session lasting 7 hours, minority Democrats unsuccessfully introduced 17 amendments, most of which addressed issues involving gas availability to Fairbanks and the Interior, and others increasing regulatory oversight, protecting consumers concerned about the possibility of high prices. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra argued that the prices will be set by the sellers and the pipeline company with little, if any, state control.
I do not trust that private corporations will always have the interests of our consumers in mind. I do not trust that the major oil producers in this state will always have the interests of Alaskans in mind. And so to let them set the rates without any meaningful review by a consumer protection agency, I think, is the wrong way to go.
The bill's sponsor, Speaker Mike Chenault, a Republican from Nikiski, said Alaskans have been waiting for a gas line for 30 years. He said without the project described in the bill, the state has no options except to watch the rail belt run out of energy. He said the success of the project will rely on alignment of all the stakeholders and interested parties.
You're not going to have a pipeline project without shippers and without customers. And that's just plain and simple. We can wait as long as we want, but until we can get those two groups together, we'll never have a project. And if we continue shooting ourselves in the foot, I can guarantee you that we will never have a gas pipeline.
The 27-12 vote was largely along caucus lines. The Senate has not yet considered the measure. Governor Sean Parnell late yesterday sent what he calls an action alert to his supporters, asking people to call in and criticize the Senate Finance Committee for cutting $5 million from a scholarship program. His administration earlier this year requested legislation concerning the program be put on hold. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The Senate hasn't finished its final version of the budget yet, but it currently flat funds the scholarship program that was one of the governor's earliest legislative accomplishments. That line in the operating budget now spends about the same amount of money as was obligated for students last year. Meanwhile, senators say they've put the administration on notice that permanent funding for the program depends on the governor. Education Subcommittee Chair Dennis Egan said the governor's action alert suggests that his group disenfranchised students who are working for the scholarships. He said the subcommittee supports the program, but also supports scholarships for other graduates who need financial help. He says the governor had promised not to use any of the $400 million set aside for the scholarships until legislation passed setting the rules for all the scholarships, both performance and needs-based.
But this year, he walked away from the bill and instead asked us to eat it into the heart of that money. His promise and his refusal to work with the Senate are what stand between the class of 2012 and the Alaska Performance Scholarship.
Egan offered to work with the governor to help provide scholarship money for those students who are financially disadvantaged, but not for what he calls willy-nilly spending with no rules. The House passed HB 104 last year as a performance grant, and the Senate was in the process of writing in a section that would have provided regulations for the needs-based portion. But on March 7th, Commissioner of Education Mike Hanley asked the Finance Committee to hold the bill, setting the stalemate in place. The governor's press secretary responded to a request for the governor's reaction with an email reading, quote, "How is advocating to establish a fund to have these scholarships in perpetuity standing between the students and their scholarships?" She left the question unanswered. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
What does it take to have a YouTube video go viral? A woman from Unalaska discovered one recipe this week. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez reports on the unlikely internet stardom of resident Pam Oss.
When Pam Oss heard a bald eagle squawking outside of her house this week, she knew it was the right time to break out the video camera.
Okay, I keep hearing these calls for me. I open my door and... Oh. Mr. Eagle keeps calling me.
Mr. Eagle wasn't the only one out on her porch. In short order, Little Fox and her two house cats named Gizmo and Suitcase had all gathered for their close-up. Oz took about a minute of tape, went back inside, and then added the footage to her YouTube channel, as she's been doing for the past 4 years. She mostly forgot about it until her daughter called her up to let her know that her video was getting hits from across the country.
I was excited because I had 1,700,000+ hits on all my videos combined, and today I just looked on there and I had over 2 million.
CBS, The Huffington Post, and Gawker Media all linked to the video within 24 hours of it being posted, and Oz says that the attention hasn't stopped.
I made me a list. I just opened it up just a couple hours ago, and it's amazing. Good Morning America and ABC News. Journalist from Australian News wants to do a story. Fox News wants to put the video on one of their nighttime shows. You know, one of those like with Greg something. I don't have TV at home. But and Yahoo wants rights to it.
Footage of cats getting stuck in boxes or playing with string is popular enough on its own. But the phenomenon of interspecies BFF videos, as in best friends forever, is internet gold. That might be why Oz's video has struck a chord, even though that she thinks that seeing the national bird around on Alaska is as common as spotting a pigeon in New York City. She doesn't expect that locals will be terribly impressed by her tape.
No, they'd go, big deal. I could have taken that on my porch, you know? Probably.
While the footage Oz shot this week might have shown peaceful interactions between her furry and feathered friends, other videos show slightly more hostile encounters. One features an eagle slapping away a tabby cat, and two others show her kitties duking it out with a fox over a can of tuna. If anything, the fact that these animals gathered peacefully is a cause for concern for her. It's been a rough winter in Unalaska, and she thinks that wild animals are interacting with humans a lot more because they're struggling to find food.
With all the snow and the bitter cold and everything that we're usually not getting here, they're begging a whole lot this winter.
For their part, people in Unalaska are mostly amused by the attention this video has been getting. They've also been tickled by YouTube comments that have suggested that the video is fake. But mostly, residents like Elizabeth Johnson are confused as to how Oz even manages to upload these videos given the town's notoriously slow internet speeds.
It must have taken her all day to get that uploaded to YouTube. With a few meltdowns and probably a couple curse words and a couple calls to the phone to her cable company or whatever. What's going on?
Oz's solution? Stand up, walk away from the computer, and admire the wildlife. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.